Great to be back with you for another GoldSeek.com radio installment. Today's featured guest, Bob Hoy from Institutional Advisors. Bob Hoy has advised institutional clients for 30 years. He's the editor and chief investment strategist of institutionaladvisors.com. Welcome back, Bob Hoy.
Chris, good to be with you.
As we were discussing before the show, the nuances and subtle differences in trading style, and you like to keep your finger directly on the pulse of the market. Give people an idea of what a typical morning involves at Institutional Advisors.
Oh, well, you know, we're out here in the West Coast, and so our day begins when the market opens at 6:30. And I think our West Coast people in the investment business enjoy it. Those who like to quit at the market close, it makes for a pleasant day because you get the afternoon off. But I'm always fascinated by the markets. You have the quotes in front of you on the screen. I don't have a huge Bloomberg or anything like that. And you have the opinion being given by the talking heads, which is always input. So, and then by later on in the day, you've had enough of the talking heads, so you turn the sound off. And then later on in the day, when I'm working, I kind of like to have action on TV, so I'll watch Turner Classic Movies. And what we're watching these days in the financial markets is the most incredible experiment by policymakers in history. This has been on for a long time, but in the last decade, they've become very frenetic, desperate. And here, I guess the big one now is the twos. They've got this idea out of nowhere that there should be 2% increase each year in the CPI. Now, I think if you talk to a mainstream economist and ask them why, they wouldn't have an answer. It's just a bureaucratic gesture. It's built into the system, and they can't get out of it, and it's arrived, the number's out of thin air. But anyways, in 20 years' time, a 2% rate of inflation will take a whole whack out of fixed income, and it's actually state theft is what it is. And but you take a look at since the Fed opened its doors in January of 1914, I think the dollar is, the purchasing power of a dollar then, today, is worth about 3.5 cents. And they call this policy making. And these guys have, again, it's straight intuition on the part of the policy making set. They, first of all, they assume that there is such a thing as a national economy that's isolated from all other economies. You have to assume that, otherwise you can't experiment in it. But, of course, it's absolutely nonsense because the connection, there are two connections from country to country. One is the credit markets, the other is trade markets. So you can't, there's no such thing as an isolated economy, even the U.S. economy. So then the other absurdity is that they saw that credit expanded with the business expansion. Sure, people borrow money. But they then make the conclusion that expanding credit forces expanding business. But that's what people call a primitive syllogism. It's the urge to conclude that because two things are occurring at the same time, there's a causal relationship. And
it's interesting you'd mention that because that's actually referred to as an Aristotelian syllogism. It's based on two premises. It's dark outside and the street lights are on. From those premises, we conclude that it is nighttime.
This is what is behind aggressive central bank policymaking. They really believe that expansion of credit forces an expansion of business, but it's not the case. As a matter of fact, you look at, and even then, commentators today are saying that the stock market is debt propelled, like it's the credit ease that's pushing stock prices. It's the other way around. Stock prices rising will eventually be margined. So there's leverage, and that's what's facilitating credit expansion. And the old idea that credit expansion pushes prices up has been seen not to work, because in the 1970s, it was credit expansion that drove CPI inflation, like you had the wholesale prices going up and consumer prices going up and wages going up.
I don't agree with that this time around, because I think the circumstances are different. In fact, I just put out an article yesterday that proposes just the opposite. For instance, this time around, the debt has been targeted specifically by the major lenders, and then that almost entirely rolled into treasury stock of these major corporations. And as they do that, they, of course, cause two major sea changes in the market. Firstly, they boost their own price by buying up their own shares. And secondly, they reduce the supply outstanding because the shares are essentially put in limbo. It's now treasury stock. Traditionally leads the stock market higher. And we've been seeing that to the tune of $4 to $5 trillion in the past 6 or 7 years. I would argue that it is at least 60 to 70% of the bull market we've seen since 2009.
Oh, I know that the treasurers have been doing stock buybacks, and they're borrowing money. It's absolutely absurd to do it. But listen to this one. In 1980-81, the view I had was, when I started presenting to institutions, was that no matter how much the Fed prints, stocks would outperform commodities. Now, at that time, the whole of the world was convinced that Fed printing was driving up commodity prices. But the reason for that was not my imagination, was that because in the commodities soared to 1920, so the big action was in tangible assets. They crashed. Then the next big action was in financial assets. The Fed didn't. Like in 1980-81, Volcker is given credit for ending price inflation. Money supply did not contract from 1980 to 81 to 82. It kept expanding. But commodities crashed. Everybody was leveraged. And then the action swung over to financial assets. Now, that was not the first time. The first time it happened was in the early 1700s, when you had a long and great inflation in tangible assets, blew out in 1711. And then what happened? Then you had an era of inflation in financial assets, and then it crashed. So this is simply my case, is that the public chooses what will be speculated in. The central bank, it's only got one tap, and it's on all of the time. But you go from in the 70s, inflation in wages and consumer prices, and then you go beginning in the 80s, you then shift it over to inflation and financial assets. So, and it's been most disappointing to the hard asset people. Gold bugs are having a terrible time explaining how you've got this reckless central bank and you've got gold in a bear market, well, in a bottoming market. So the main thing is that there is nothing new in the financial markets, and the game of credit expansion is not clearly understood.
Bob, are you at your computer? I just sent to both of your email addresses a chart that I put out yesterday that I came across. It's the monetary base as composed by the St. Louis Fed, and it's, I think, one of the more impressive. I mean, this is not new news. We've all known the money base has been expanded dramatically over the last few years. But this chart, I think, is emblematic. It really illustrates. It's the adjusted monetary base from the St. Louis Fed, text on it and pointing out some of the more important changes. And if you go back to the recession, what we refer to as the Great Recession from around 2008-2009, anyone like yourself who follows the markets minute to minute, tick to tick, at least in the early part of the day will remember that was the end of the world. If you remember 2007, 2008, and early 2009, I mean, the financial markets were dead. All the blue chip stocks went to zero. People don't want to admit this, but the financial markets froze up and died.
On a boom, typically the yield curve will flatten or steepen or eventually become inverted. Usually it runs for 12 to 18 months against the boom. And then when the curve reverses and starts to steepen, it then says that the credit contraction is going to start. Now that count, and we counted it from January 2007, would be that June would be the 16th month. And our target was that in June, the credit markets would reverse. They started to reverse in that May. Now, I was in London at a financial thing for institutions on, I think it was June the 8th, and I pointed out on the slideshow I had, it showed a terrible train wreck. And the advice was that the greatest train wreck in the history of credit has started, and it started on schedule. So this was based on financial history, the way the markets really work, not how they ought to work. So I rest very comfortably with the idea that the public...
Well, first of all, let me say hat tip for that presentation. But nevertheless, I'd like to stick on this topic because you're focusing in on what I wanted to be the crux of today's dialogue. You know, Fed officials more than doubled the money supply during 2008-2009. And this chart I sent to you, I think, really illustrates this. And it's up here for everyone to see on our web pages and, you know, public world to either, you know, throw tomatoes at if you like. That's fine. I'd like your comments on this because it really required more than a doubling. Folks are so used to these numbers, big numbers, that I think it almost glosses over. It's just over people's heads. They're tired of hearing it. But I'm talking about deflating the value of every dollar in existence by half, more than half, in just a matter of 3 or 4 months. That's what was required to keep the economic patient alive. And you might think, well, that was the end of it. Another doubling was required from 2009 to 2011, and then another doubling from 2012 to 2014. And this process you'd think would be over now, right? Because unemployment, national unemployment rate is down so low. 100 million Americans are unemployed, 93 million to be exact. But still, we're apparently in this great recovery, Bob. It's only required a 4- to 5-fold increase in the money supply, depending on where you look back to. The chart I just sent to you indicates it's in a consolidation and ready to break out to another high, which would require another 50 to 100% increase in the money supply just to maintain economic conditions as they are now. Tell me how this is not Zimbabwe or Weimar. I'm all ears.
In Germany in the 1920s had no credit markets. So they were able to do the currency inflation, just printing it, and we've all seen pictures of the wheelbarrow. Same with Zimbabwe, but it's entirely different when you're in one of the bigger economies and through these periods, the senior economy, where you have a huge credit market and they cannot do a Weimar inflation. It won't happen. Now, also on your chart of the expansion of the monetary base, note that it didn't really begin to expand until the crisis was over and bond prices and commodity prices and stock prices started going up. So my thesis is that the Fed needs speculators to bid assets up and borrow the money. It's not the idea of the Fed expansion pushes prices up is just doesn't work in history. So what I look at this chart here, if you didn't have the greatest bubble in bonds in history, the monetary base wouldn't have expanded. So what you have now, I believe what will happen is that now it was our January 20 piece on the long-dated U.S. Treasuries, the speculation there, and we called it ending action, and noted that we were bullish on the bonds since 1981, and that this was the end of the great bull market in bonds. And then it also, in that paper we did in late January, said that the top in the U.S. Treasury market, which was late January, would be followed by the end of speculation in European bonds. And then since April 20th, the rise in the German 10-year note has been huge. And yet the Bundesbank or the European Central Bank has not stopped buying. Financial history has been driven by market forces, not policymakers. So here's what I think is going to happen. Bonds trashed, stocks trashed, further weakness in commodities, and then the central bankers will be cut off at the knees. They will not be able to be as aggressive as they have been. And it's also, you mentioned how forceful the central bankers have been with the 2008 crash. It's not widely published, but in the 1929 crash, the Fed eased hugely. The New York Fed, which is the big chapter then and it still is, it opened the discount window and bought bonds out of the market and exceeded its authority by a factor of 6 times. The Federal Reserve at that time was fully aware of Bagehot's dictum, which dates back to 1873, that in the signs of trouble, the central bank eases. Well, they did, and you still had a crash. It's just like in 2007, the central bank didn't tighten. They kept the pedal to the metal, and the whole thing still crashed. Okay. And then the expansion in the monetary base didn't happen until the markets allowed it to happen by having a speculative run in stocks and bonds. And since 2011, now there's another date, a model we call the momentum price forecaster, peak momentum forecaster. It called for a huge top in commodities, basic commodities plus gold and silver in 2011. And we called it a cyclical top, and there would be a cyclical bear market. Well, there's been a cyclical bear market in base metals and precious metals since. By the way, this year we expected a rotation out of Christmas whereby these depressed commodities would rally out to about May. So, Chris, I'm going to stay with my thesis that the markets allow the central bankers to become reckless. And when the market, and then you've got on the bonds, you had extreme technical excesses, and it's going the other way. And this will be one of the most severe credit contractions in history. This is going to make 2008 look like just a blip.
I've got to respectfully disagree on at least one or two key points here. And what I've done, I've sent you another chart. And for our listeners, all you have to do is click the chart at the Nuggets webpage. And when you press your button, your mouse button over that, it will take you to the Fed's St. Louis adjusted monetary base. Bob, that's what I've just sent to you while you were speaking. Just quickly dropped it in an email, sent it over to you. Now, if you look at this chart, you'll notice from 1985, the Fed's monetary base all the way till about 1995, it took a 10-year period for the monetary base to double. Let's go from 1995 all the way to, okay, just at the beginning of 2009. So there it took, I don't know, 95, almost 15 years, 14 years for the monetary base to double again. My hypothesis is this. Instead of 10 or 14 years, the Fed doubled the monetary base, Bob, in the matter of roughly 1 or 2 months. Then again, they did the same thing in, I'm looking at the chart here again, around 2012 to 2013. And then they did it again in 2013, 2014. Actually, that time they did more than doubled the monetary base. And it is my argument that you are right, that for all those previous periods you talked about, even going back to 1929, which would be your domain more than mine, I would agree with you. However, everything changed. When we were discussing earlier that 2007 through 2009, the financial markets ended. My argument is it really was the end of the world, meaning, and it never stopped. If the Fed has had to increase the monetary base almost fivefold, Bob, in essence, doubling it almost every year since 2009, to make us tread water. We're not in any massive economic expansion here. I think few people would really agree with that other than a mainline economist. If it has required that level, and if you look at the chart, you can see we are on the verge, on the cusp of parabolic money growth. I'd like to know how that does not end in hyperinflation.
Now, in the conventional description of inflation, it is soaring prices, isn't it? Here's what, if you want to navigate through financial history, the old classical definition of inflation works, and that is an inordinate expansion of credit. It is not an inordinate expansion of prices, but that inordinate expansion of credit will be against one or two things. It'll be against tangible assets as to 1920, and then it will be against financial assets as to 1929. Now, in our own world here, the speculation in CPI and wages peaked in 1980 with a CPI of 14%. And even with this reckless expansion of monetary base since 2010, you're not getting any CPI inflation because you have inflation in financial assets. And this gets back to my point, is that the public chooses what it's going to speculate in. Into 1920, they chose to speculate in hard assets. And then the crash in 1921 had nothing to do with policy. But the Fed got very concerned about that crash. You look at the chart of the commodities. It's the biggest straight up and the biggest straight down in you know, one of them. So anyways, the Fed spent the 1920s easing money, being concerned to keeping prices from falling, consumer producer price or consumer prices. And they were looking over their shoulder at the stock markets because they didn't understand the stock market. So all of the extra lolly went into stock speculation. And the Fed did not tighten in 1929. That's a myth. That in the early 30s, those in the know knew that the crash and the depression was caused by the boom. But it wasn't until the 1960s when you had macroeconomics come along, and in order to employ their theories, they had to have a perfectly functioning agency such as the Fed. So that's when they began to say that the Fed made an error in 1929 and was tight.
From what I've read in history, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but from what I've read, I think it was Chairman Martin at the time, the Fed had quite an expansionary policy. In fact, in the 1920s, that's when they began, for the first time, their open market operations, which they've continued to do for nearly 100 years. And you might recall, they refused to raise interest rates, which kind of fueled the flames of the stock market boom all the more. They wouldn't allow rates to rise to a more natural level. And of course, that increases speculation as we're seeing today.
They were very easy money policy through the mid-1920s. And it brewed up into a fantastic bubble, just like 1873. Or anyway, you know, they're all the same, these bubbles. You could take a chart of South Sea Company in 1720, and you can overlay it on a chart of Radio Corp of America, RCA, in 1929. You can overlay it on a chart of Cisco, say, in 2000. And you can overlay it on a chart now of IBB, which is the biotechs. So they're all the same. But the instruction is, in one era, Fed reckless or central bank recklessness will be part of a rise in tangible assets, commodities. And then in the next era, after they crash, the next era, it is in financial assets. So I suggest to you now that what has been going on in the bond market is the equivalent of the Weimar inflation of the 1920s. You have had hyperinflation in bond prices, okay? Now what happens when you get price of any asset bid to the moon? Everybody's in. It's the trade of the day. It's crowded. And then
let me answer that, because back in 2000, the dot-com zenith, that money, which everyone thought would disappear, rolled into the real estate market, and we had nearly a 5 to 6 year bubble in real estate.
In a classic bubble such as 1929 or 1720, it's stock prices, and it is also some speculation in commodities, their firm. That's why 2000 wasn't a 1929 type of bubble. So then you have a bid for real estate because everybody's making so much money in the stock market that they upscale in houses. It's all happened. So at any rate, the thing that I'd like to get across is that the Fed can only expand credit. The public chooses what it's going to speculate in, and you have had the equivalent of a Weimar inflation in the bond market, and that burned up. It's starting to collapse now. So we will look perhaps this time next year at the monetary base, and I would suggest that it'll be way lower because of deflation and huge speculation in bond prices. And well, that's it. So here's what we're looking for now is that this setback to European bond market has been horrendous. I mean, this when you get the yield on the 10-year note in Germany go from less than 0.1% to 0.65%, that's a price drop. The shorts have made huge money on that, and they will gang up and they'll keep hitting each of these bond issues. So we've had hyperinflation since coming out of the 2009 contraction, and the hyperinflation has been in stocks and bonds. It has not been in gold. It's not been in copper, but it's been in the game that the public choose to play. Now, here's the other thing, Chris, is that while most think that the Federal Reserve is responsible in this speculation, it isn't. And then most think that it has all the power in the world. It doesn't, because is that once you're at the top, the power flows to the margin clerk. Now, of late, the job description of a central banker is to get the stock accounts and bond accounts offside, everybody leveraged. But, of course, the basic job description of a margin clerk is the opposite. His job is to get the accounts in line. And even the South Sea Bubble of 1720, it was a government-inspired bubble. They had the key stock, the South Sea Company, and they had the Bank of England, and it was all a go because it was funding the state. And they did everything they could to keep that bubble going. But in June of 1720, it ran out of energy, and it spent the summer turning around, and it crashed in the fall. And this is also our target on the stock market here. Peak now, churn through the summer. This is on the hot items like IBB, and then failure in the fall. So we'll see, and perhaps in the fall we can review just how the margin clerks can do it to the central bankers. I love it when it happens because it shows, as in 2008, that the greatest easing in the world could not prevent that stock market from concluding a panic selling.
Bob, I think that we agree on so many issues here. What I find fascinating is we've come to remarkably similar conclusions on totally different tacks. And I would also, you know, take issue with that last statement. If you look at the two charts I've sent over to you, and listeners can do the same, you'll see that it required, I don't think this is really my opinion. I mean, I think it's prima facie evidence on the chart. It required at least a doubling of the money supply to save all financial markets from complete annihilation. I would say we were within days to weeks away from all markets closing and going to zero. And I admit I'm probably alone on this. I don't know. I'd like to hear from listeners if you agree or whether you don't. I believe this chart shows the markets still are at zero, meaning that without government entirely, what I'm saying is the entire financial markets, and I know this is in stark contrast with your opinion and your work, Bob, but I'm of the belief that it is entirely the Federal Reserve, not 99%, 100% responsible for the fact that the financial markets are operating today. Were they to pull the plug even, let's say marginally, 15 to 20%, I think all markets would shut down that day. In other words, I would say that the chairman of the Federal Reserve controls the entire world. Were they to change this policy according to these charts, and again, this is just, I think, proven by the parabolic nature of this chart. And this is where we agree. I believe we are in the midst of a silent hyperinflation, and there is no way to go but up here with the monetary policy. If that ever were to change, I can tell you right now, I would get out of the Western world immediately, because I think everything will shut down. But I mean, all you have to do is see that it required 100 years to pump as much money into the system as we have in just a matter of a few years here. That is, to me, what I'd say 1920, 1921 in the Weimar. It's just a matter of time before John Williams at Shadow Stats, I think, is proven correct. We will have a hyperinflationary boom and then collapse. And we're in the middle of it right here.
Yeah, I would just say that you're giving too much credit to the Fed for ending the collapse in 2009. It was a natural one. Deserves a serious criticism is that in December 2007, just as the stock market was rolling over, Greg Mankiw, a Harvard macroeconomist, come out and said nothing could go wrong because the Fed had a dream team of economists. Now then you go into the worst financial collapse since the 1930s, and once it stabilized and started to recover in 2009, then the Fed was going around saying that if it hadn't have been for us, the panic would have lasted forever. Now consider this. In 2007, the establishment said nothing could go wrong. In 2009, the Fed said, without us, the wrong would last forever. I mean, this is so absurd. So then you want to look back on all of the great booms in history and the great crashes. They've all crashed in the fall. And they've all ended on their own. The notion that the Fed stopped the contraction in 2009 is completely unfounded.
I take issue at that point because, from my perspective, quantitative easing worked very well for the Weimar Republic for a couple of years too, and everything seemed to be back on track. But once they fire up the printing presses in this fashion, history supports the notion that there's only one way that you can go. You have to continue stoking those flames, because as soon as they're extinguished, the entire system implodes. And we have really, in my opinion, been living on life support since 2000 and at least 9. You know, this is what makes a market.
What this is the first bull market and the first economic expansion out of a classic crash. So it's sort of like 1937. And then we're about to, I think we're, the financial markets by September, we will know, probably really know that they're heading south. That would be both stocks and bonds, in which case the ability of the Fed to stimulate, expand, or whatnot, this will be the end of interventionist central banking.
Bob, it's just the beginning. Look at the chart. There's nowhere to go but up. We're at the top of the range. If this were a stock, you'd want to be buying right here. It's going to the moon from here. You're going to see $6.5 trillion on the Fed's balance sheet.
The margin clerks will have taken over and will have overwhelmed central bankers once again. There has been, since early 1700s, there has been, this is now the sixth example of financial asset inflation, and all five previous ones collapsed and led to a long contraction.
Okay, but point out one time in history where the monetary base, the QE operations were this intense and you didn't have hyperinflation. I can't find one.
Yeah, you're right, Chris, but I keep telling you that the hyperinflation is in the bond market. Bond market fails, the monetary base is going to collapse. Hey, let's talk about it in December.
All right, it'll be interesting. I'll give you a chance to tell folks a little bit more about your services.
We cover commodities, we cover currencies, equity markets, and fixed income. So we cover the whole thing. And I think we probably have the greatest recovery of history of any service that's providing opinion and suggestions on this market. Institutionaladvisors.com, or if you just Google my name, B-O-B-H-O-Y-E, it gets you into all our systems. You can get on for, we run about 5 or 6 weeks on a free subscription, and then you either want to get on board or whatnot. So anyways, always good to talk, Chris.
Thanks, Bob. Thanks for being patient with me and giving us lively debate here today.
Anytime.
Here is your mining quiz for the day, compliments of GoldSeek. Which company has the largest undeveloped gold reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold. Now, which company has the largest undeveloped copper reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold again. Seabridge has more gold reserves than Kinross, Yamana, and Agnico Eagle. Last year alone, Seabridge added 515 million tons of new inferred resources containing nearly 6 million ounces of gold and more than 6 billion pounds of copper at their giant KSM project in British Columbia, Canada. Now they are drilling at KSM again with multiple rigs in a 25,000-meter program. Find out more by visiting www.seabridgegold.net. Traded on the NYSE, symbol SA, and the TSX, symbol SEA.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.